From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is the worst outbreak of violence on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation since the 71-day siege at Wounded Knee 2 years ago.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American from the state of North Dakota. Currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents in Leavenworth, United States Penitentiary.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not.
Today, a conversation with Leonard Peltier from Leavenworth. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bashar al-Assad moved closer to the Syrian presidency today as he prepared for tomorrow's funeral of his father, Hafez al-Assad. He was named head of the armed forces today as a Damascus Journal published his first interview recorded a week before Hafez al-Assad's death. Bashar was quoted as saying he will pursue his father's policy for full restoration of Syrian territory in the ongoing Mideast peace process. The funeral tomorrow takes place on a hill in Damascus, followed by a burial in Hafez's hometown. Numerous heads of state are scheduled to attend. We're joined on the telephone right now by Hussein Ibish, communications director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Hussein Ibish.
Thanks.
Can you start off by giving us a thumbnail sketch of the life of Hafez al-Assad?
Sure. Hafez al-Assad comes from a relatively modest background. He's a member of the Alawite religious minority in Syria, and he was part of the Ba'athist Party, which is an Arab nationalist and socialist party. And he came to power through a coup, but an internal coup within a sort of existing Ba'athist structure. He was a minister of defense before he came to power. I think that he's likely to be remembered, at least in the Middle East, for two main things. First, the stability he brought to Syria. I mean, really before his period of rule, Syria was a very factionalized country. It was prone to lots of coups. And it wasn't politically very stable. One of the things that has characterized the Assad years in Syria has been a very strong degree of stability, achieved with a certain amount of ruthlessness, but without, an overwhelming police state, as we've seen in some other places in the Middle East and throughout the Third World. The other thing that I think Assad is likely to be remembered for is his masterful diplomacy. I think that he's one of the great sort of foreign policy tacticians of his generation anywhere in the world. And he really maneuvered Syria into a position of influence and importance and centrality in Middle Eastern affairs, which is not commensurate with the economic or military power of Syria. But through clever diplomacy and through very creative strategies, he was able to keep his country at the center of all of the debates and really maximize its influence with very limited resources. So I think for that, people are going to really remember him as one of the most brilliant diplomats of the 20th century.
Can you tell us about Bashar al-Assad, the man who's expected to assume the presidency, Hafez al-Assad's son?
Sure. He is a quiet and unassuming young ophthalmologist, British-trained, very well-educated, technologically oriented, but of course relatively inexperienced. He's a young man, technically younger than the Syrian constitution was supposed to allow a president to become. That's been quickly amended. And I think that he's generally untested, although in a sense he grew up in this sort of quintessentially political family. On the other hand, he actually hasn't been tested at all. I think that it may be that he proves to be a transitional figure in Syria. It may be that certainly the entire Syrian power structure is behind him for now, because having him assume the presidency ensures stability. And if he is going to be a transitional figure, it will allow for a gradual change in regime. On the other hand, he may prove to be a very capable political leader and be around for a long time. We'll just have to wait and see.
And how do you think Bashar al-Assad will continue the Middle East negotiations? In fact, President Clinton only recently met with his father.
Well, I think it's very likely that any Syrian government, any successor regime, whether Bashar al-Assad or in the long run somebody else, is going to maintain the same basic policy that Syria has had for the past couple of decades, really, which is that peace with Israel is full, normal peace with Israel is possible and desirable, but only in the context of a complete Israeli withdrawal from all of the Golan Heights. And I think this represents not the whim or caprice of Hafez al-Assad or Bashar al-Assad or a small ruling clique, but it represents a very strong, deeply felt consensus in Syrian society and actually throughout the feelings of the Arab peoples of the world. And I think that it's very, very likely that any successor regime is going to stick to that. I think that it's badly misunderstood in the United States that this was some kind of personal opinion of President Assad. It isn't. It's deeply felt.
Hussein Ebashoma, thank you for being with us, spokesperson for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee.
It was the worst outbreak of violence on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation since the 71-day siege at Wounded Knee 2 years ago. Police sources said the agents may have survived the initial gunfire, only to be executed later. Then there was another heavy exchange of fire. One Indian was shot dead. The rest of the Indians escaped.
Bondage. The people pray to freedom as freedom cries. A man waits in a cage. A man calls to justice, but justice lies in the dream of the living. Lies change, genocide remains.
Leonard Peltier. Today, a conversation with him at Leavenworth Prison on the day of his interim parole hearing. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says he should be freed. Amnesty International calls him a political prisoner. The FBI says he's a cold-blooded murderer. Today, we'll spend the hour with him. Peltier will be reviewed for parole at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. Amnesty International will attend the hearing in person to ask the commission to set Leonard Peltier free. The National Council of Churches, the National Congress of American Indians, the Assembly of First Nations, and Peltier's family will also be asking the parole commission for Leonard Peltier's release. Peltier underwent his first full parole hearing in 1993, at which point the Parole Commission denied his release far beyond what their guidelines recommend and set his next full hearing for the year 2008. However, the commission is required to hold hearings every 2 years in order to determine whether there are any circumstances that warrant a change in their original decision. The Parole Commission originally denied Peltier parole based on their finding that he, quote, participated in the premeditated and cold-blooded execution of those two officers, unquote. However, the commission has since said it, quote, recognizes that the prosecution has conceded the lack of any direct evidence that Peltier personally participated in the execution of the two FBI agents. Leonard Peltier, who has served over 24 years of a sentence and has maintained a good behavior record during his incarceration, has been eligible for release for over 9 years. Today, a parole examiner will hear the case and make an initial recommendation as to whether or not the Parole Commission should grant Peltier a date to be released. On February 27, 1973, members of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, together with a number of local and traditional Native Americans, began their 72-day occupation of Wounded Knee. They were protesting injustices against their tribes, violations of treaties, and current abuses and repression against their people. The U.S. government responded with a military-style assault against the protesters. In the end, various officials promised hearings on local conditions and treaty violations. They were never convened. Throughout the next 3 years, long referred to by local Native Americans as the Reign of Terror, the FBI carried out intensive local surveillance as well as repeated arrests, harassment, and legal proceedings against AIM leaders and supporters. The FBI also closely collaborated with and supported the local tribal chairperson, Dick Wilson, and his selected vigilantes, the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, also known by the acronym GOONS. During this period, some 64 local Native Americans were killed. In May of 75, the FBI began a sizable buildup of its agents, mostly SWAT members, on the reservation. In June 74, SWAT teams from numerous divisions were designated for special assignment at Pine Ridge. Yet the politically related murder rate climbed. A June 1975 FBI memo referred to the potential need for military assault forces to deal with AIM members. On June 26, 1975, two FBI agents, Jack Kohler and Ron Williams, entered the Jumping Bull Ranch in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The FBI says they were seeking to arrest a young Native American man they believed they had seen riding in a red pickup truck. A large number of AIM supporters were camping at the property at the time. More than 30 men, women, and children on the property were surrounded by more than 150 FBI agents, SWAT team members, BIA, that's Bureau of Indian Affairs Police, and local posse members, and barely escaped through a hail of bullets. When the gunfight ended, a Native American named Joe Stuntz lay dead. His killing was never investigated. Two FBI agents, Kohler and Williams, were also dead. They had been wounded in the gunfight and then shot point blank through the head by a still unidentified assailant. Leonard Peltier was one of several AIM members who was involved with the shootout. And I had a chance to interview him in a rare extended interview in Leavenworth on Friday, speaking to him by telephone. And these are large excerpts of that interview.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American from the state of North Dakota. I am currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents in Leavenworth, United States Penitentiary.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not. No.
Maybe we could go back to that day that these FBI agents were killed, and you could tell us what happened.
Well, at that time, there was what is known as today's a region of terror going on against traditional people from the so-called progressives under a tribal chairman named Dick Wilson, who was very corrupt, who organized his own private police force, kind of like a Contra group, and started terrorizing his own people, his own traditionalists on the reservation. So the traditionalists asked for the help of the American Indian Movement. And the end results of, after long protests and not getting no responses from any law enforcement agency in the country, Wounded Knee 2 was then occupied, and there was a 71-day siege. After that, Dick Wilson again intensified his goon squads, and the General Accounting Service, an agency of the United States government, did an investigation, and before the funding was ran out, they found over 60 murdered Indian people, traditionalists and stuff. On June 26th, we didn't know it at the time, but we knew later from Freedom of Information documents that FBI with the goon squads were planning on attacks on the Jumping Bull Ranch and another ranch in Kyle, that's another community on the reservation, that they were declaring the American Indian Movement strongholds. And on June 26, a firefight started, and the end results was two FBI agents and one young Indian man was killed. And they indicted four of us
Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler, Jimmy Eagle. After a year, they dropped the charges on Jimmy Eagle. And Bob and Dino went to trial in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and was found not guilty by reasons of self-defense. I was later, my trial was mysteriously moved from Cedar Rapids, which I was supposed to go to trial the same place under the same judge, as my co-defendants, was mysteriously moved to Fargo, North Dakota. Later documents show that the FBI then went judge shopping to get a judge to work closely with them, and Judge Paul Benson agreed to do it. And, I was not allowed to put up a defense. They manufactured evidence, the murder weapon. It was perjury by government witnesses, and the judge erred in his rulings, which prevented me from putting up a defense. This was on my. This all came out in my 1985 appeal under the ballistics. They had taken this gun during the trial and claimed, no one testified this was my weapon, by the way, but they had taken this weapon and said, this was the murder weapon, and this belonged to Leonard Peltier. Well, we weren't allowed to properly cross-examine the firearms expert of the FBI. So this was left then as only on the word of the prosecutor that this was my weapon and that this was the murder weapon. Through the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, we were able to discover that they had done a firing test on this weapon and it came out negative. So I filed a 1985 appeal. And because my attorney, Bill Kunstler, made a mistake, I'm now serving two consecutive life terms in prison, possibly for the rest of my life if it's left up to the FBI on the technicality.
What was the mistake?
Well, the judge asked him if I was changing my plea, and also because Norman Brown testified that he'd seen me down by the agents, the car agents' car, and Kunstler agreed with him that Norman Brown testified to this, and this was never.
This call is from a federal prison.
And this was untrue. This Norman Brown never testified to that. In fact, nobody testified to that.
Who was Norman Brown?
He was one of the three young men that was taken and interrogated under very brutal tactics, tied to chairs. Their lives were threatened. Their families were threatened to testify against Bob and Dino and myself.
Leonard Peltier, why weren't you tried along with your co-defendants, Dino Butler and Bob Robidoux?
Well, I was at the time I had got arrested in Canada. I was I'd been back and forth to Canada numerous times, about four times before I was arrested over there. But going to Canada with a lot of Native Americans that lived in Montana, Washington State, North Dakota, Minnesota is like crossing another border for us. We're all across the Canadian border. There's a treaty with the United States government and Canada that we Native Americans are allowed to do this because they split some of our lands, our reservation lands, and part of it was Canada and part of the United States. So we go across like going to another state. And I had been over there three or four times, but I finally got arrested over there, so I decided to fight extradition because I was, you know, well aware that Native Americans could not receive justice in the courts and that, you know, the 99% of us would get railroaded. So especially the American Indian Movement people. So I started fighting extradition. But I also made a formal request that I wanted to go to trial with my co-defendants. But somehow the government got to speed up the trial and they took my co-defendants to trial first.
Over the years, there's been discussion of someone named Mr. X who has come forward and admitted to some that he killed the two FBI agents. Leonard Peltier, can you explain who Mr. X is?
Mr. X could be anybody. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that somebody killed those agents, but we don't know who it is.
In the first trial, the trial of Robidoux and Butler, they were acquitted by reason of self-defense.
Yes.
Why do you think in your trial the jury didn't come to the same conclusion?
Well, they had a judge that was that believed in prayer or equal justice for all, and he allowed my co-defendants to put up a defense. And they put up a defense showing that the Jumping Bull Ranch was under siege, under attack, and that first of all, the FBI was claiming that they were there looking for Jimmy Eagle because of a kidnapping charge. This is what they released in the newspapers, and this was their reasons for being there on the Jumping Bull Ranch. But all the records came out, they found out he was looking. They were looking for him, which they don't have jurisdictions for, over, pursuing a pair of cowboy boots, and they were allowed to. People were allowed to come and testify on their behalf of what was going on the reservation, the terror, the murders that was being committed against them, the fire bombing of their homes, the drive-by shootings, and et cetera. Plus the fact there was no evidence against them, as there was none in mine. In 1985, the Judge Haney, I believe it was Judge Haney, one of the three judges asked the prosecutor in my case, he said, just what was Mr. Peltier convicted of, as we cannot find no evidence of murder in the record. And, of course, that's when the prosecutor, Lynn Crooks, made the statement that we don't know who killed the agents, nor do we know what participation Leonard Peltier may have played in it.
Have you admitted shooting at the agents?
Have I admitted it? Not specifically them. I'm defending myself. I was defending women and children. We were under attack.
Can you explain more fully what happened that day when you say you were under attack? Who were these men who had pulled up? Did you understand that they were FBI agents?
No, nobody knew they were FBI agents. Just, because of the terror that was going on, the tension that was so high on the reservation, people were very jumpy. People were people that we were going to funerals every week, sometimes two a week. And people were very paranoid. People were very tensed. And that's what people were living under.
In the trial, they said that the agents, Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams, were shot at point-blank range. Did you see a man shoot them at point-blank range?
No, I did not see a man shoot those people at cold-blank range. But there was also over 60 Indian people that were killed at cold-blank range. Why isn't the media asking about that stuff? What are we, animals, that nobody cares?
Can you talk about that, happened?
Yeah, there was over 60... the number is higher than that, but there was over 60 Native American people killed on that reservation.
In what period?
From 73 to 76.
And who do you believe they were killed by?
Well, we know from Dwayne Brewer, who was the head of the goon squads, that he made a statement, a public statement, that they were being financed, given intelligence, armor-piercing ammunition, and sophisticated weaponry from the FBI. He was the leader of this guy. This guy made a public statement of a couple of killings that he did.
Was anyone ever prosecuted?
No, he's never been arrested, never been charged, or anything else like this. I mean, why is people worried about two FBI agents when all these Indian people were killed? I don't understand this.
This call is from a federal prison.
If this happened in a black community or a white community, the media would be outraged. I mean, we're human beings too.
Leonard Peltier speaking to us from Leavenworth Penitentiary. He is serving two life sentences for first-degree murder and the killing of two FBI agents in the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. Today is an interim parole hearing for him. We'll continue the conversation in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Uh-huh.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue the interview with Native American leader Leonard Peltier at Leavenworth Prison. I conducted the interview on Friday morning. Today is his interim parole hearing. Many will be there testifying on Peltier's behalf. At Leonard Peltier's trial in the 1970s, the prosecutor wrapped up his case by saying, quote, "We prove that he went down to the bodies and executed those two young men at point-blank range." He was referring to the FBI agents. But at the appellate hearing years later, the prosecutor conceded, quote, "We had a murder. We had numerous shooters. We do not know who specifically fired what killing shots. We do not know who shot the agents." As we continue now with Leonard Peltier.
You have served 24 years in prison?
Yes, 24 years.
Monday. You have served 24 years in prison?
Yes, 24 years, yes.
Monday is an interim parole hearing for you. What do you expect?
Sorry to say this, but even though we're putting on a full effort to try to get parole, I don't expect anything. I don't expect to get reconsideration for parole.
What, when you say you're putting out a full effort, what is it that will be presented?
Well, politicians, the Hollywood celebrities, academics, unions, and the general public are putting on a campaign to get parole granted to me in support of my parole.
Is it up to Janet Reno, the Attorney General, anymore?
I believe it is. I believe it is. I filed a clemency petition in 1992. And the procedures of that is it goes from the pardons attorney to the attorney general's office, then to Clinton's. The pardons attorney's office did the investigation. I think they did about a year long investigation. They did a little longer. It takes normally from 6 to 9 months. After about a year, she made the recommendation that I be granted clemency because of the seriousness of my illegal conviction, and it's been sitting in the Attorney General's office ever since.
Going back to that day, what happened to the Native American, Joe Stuntz?
Well, again, I didn't see that. I know that, and all I seen was photographs, but it looks like he was shot before it. He was murdered, he was killed.
Was anyone ever prosecuted for that killing?
There wasn't. Never even an investigation.
Leonard Peltier, when did you realize these men who were killed were FBI agents?
Well, I guess, I don't know, probably later on that day or next day, I'm not sure. I mean, everybody was trying to get away from there. I was responsible for a number of young kids' safety, and nobody was thinking about anything. Everybody was thinking about trying to get out of that area that was surrounded by over 250 people, and being shot at continuously. The firefight started approximately about 10 or 11 that morning and lasted till about 8 o'clock that night.
Why weren't you granted a new trial?
Well, under the American system, somebody has to pay. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's guilt or innocent. When something that they consider this serious, somebody has to pay. I mean, like I say, even the appellate judge has written letters because of the seriousness of the constitutional violations involved in this case. Has asked Reagan, Bush. I'm not sure if he wrote one to Clinton yet, but asking that I be granted clemency.
Ultimately, the president has the power to grant you clemency?
Yes. Yes.
What would you say to President Clinton?
Well, I've told him that I was innocent. I've written a couple letters to him, and it was hand-carried to him. And I would like to go home to my family, and I'd like to continue to try to live out what little life I have left on this earth. Try to do something for, try to do something for the current issues that we're having problems with on reservations around the country.
What were your thoughts when President Clinton visited the Native American reservations on a poverty tour of the United States?
Well, I thought it was a good move in the sense that it opened a lot of eyes, a lot of people's eyes around the world to the conditions that Native people have to live under here in America. I mean, there's poverty on those reservations that's just as bad, if not worse, than some of these third world countries. And I don't know if this is going to help. I haven't gotten any feedback from anybody. But, Amy, they're going to shut this off in about 10 seconds, so...
Can you call me right back?
I'm going to try to call right back. I don't know if it's going to do it. I don't know if they set it up this way or not.
Well, Leonard Peltier, let me ask you, perhaps the most damning evidence against you was the affidavit signed by Myrtle Poorbear, the local Native American woman.
Myrtle Poorbear was a fraud. It has been proven over and over in court.
At that point, Leonard Peltier was cut off in the conversation from the Leavenworth Penitentiary, where he was speaking from. And this is the custom at the prison. Every 10 or 15 minutes or so, the conversation got cut off, but he was then able to call back.
Every 15 minutes. But anyway, as I was saying, Myrtle Poorbear has been exposed from the beginning to be a fraud. I never met this lady in my life. I never had seen her until she walked into the courtroom in Fargo, North Dakota. But Myrtle Poorbear had given three affidavits to the extradition courts in Canada, have me extradited from Canada. They did not have enough evidence to extradite me from Canada, so they had to have, under the Canadian law, they had to have the same type of evidence that they would have in a preliminary hearing to take somebody to trial there as to send them back to the United States. So they didn't have this type of evidence. So what they did then is that they created Myrtle Poorbear. Myrtle Poorbear gave the first affidavit, which we didn't receive until during my trial, actually. But the first affidavit was so outrageous. I mean, this was, I just couldn't do nothing, even though it was so serious, I couldn't do nothing but just laugh at it. She claims that she came running up behind me and started beating on my back as I was shooting the agents, and she jumped on my back. And some guy, who I don't know who to this day, who the hell he is, but some guy named Ricky Littleboy, grabbed her by the hair, threw her on the ground. He rolled around the ground, picked up a .30-30 Winchester, jumped on the back of his horse, and took off at full gallop. She looked behind her, and Ricky Littleboy was chasing her on another horse, shooting at her. So she started shooting back at him until she was finally able to escape. Now, this was the type of person that they were using as a witness to violate not only American law, but Canadian law and international law. The first affidavit that was... Now, the next affidavit that they presented to the... The affidavit that they finally sent to Canada, of course, was all typed up, and gave a scenario of what happened on the reservation, and that I had told her, she had seen me kill the agents. She had been my girlfriend and stuff like this, and that's her signature. Well, during Bob and Dino's trial, they had also on discovery. Got a third affidavit. The third affidavit apparently wasn't good enough. What she had all said, what they had written for her wasn't strong enough. And all they wrote in her is that she had, I had told her later on, a couple of days later, that I had killed those agents. Right? Okay, so I'm extradited on those affidavits. If they hadn't used those affidavits, I would have been extradited on a Wisconsin attempted murder charge that I had that I went to trial on, was found not guilty, because I wasn't guilty. It was just a fist fight, and they tried to blow it up because I was an American Indian Movement member. So at the trial, when she was coming to my trial, she was on the witness list. Her father and her sister came to my defense and said, "We're going to testify on your behalf." The father was going to testify that Myrtle Poorbear had rheumatic fever when she was about 9 years old and had an enormous imagination. Of course, from the first affidavit, you can see that was true. The sister was going to testify that on that day, her and Myrtle were drinking, and they were leaving the reservation. They're going off the reservation to pick up some more beer when they heard of the firefight going on in Ogallala on the radio, car radio. So when the government seen that her father and sister was going to be on my witness list, they immediately recused her. So we tried to get her back as my witness to show the misconduct by the FBI in this whole case, what was going on. The judge held an evidentiary hearing without the presence of the jury. And he made a statement. He said that if I was to allow her testimony to be heard, which he testified that the FBI had forced her to sign these affidavits. They had threatened her life. They had held her captive in some hotel room. They had showed her pictures of one of the Ames sisters that was killed and her hands was cut off. And told her that the same thing would happen to her, that the American Indian Movement would be after her, and they would do this to her too, claiming that we were the ones that cut off her hands. But we know from the record that, and the FBI admitted it, that they cut her hands off. But anyway, she made this test. She testified to this at the trial. That's the first time I ever seen her. The judge made a ruling that she was incompetent and that if her testimony was to be heard, it would shock the conscience of the court. So she was not allowed to not allowed to testify on my behalf. The Supreme Court of Canada also had a hearing and investigation and found that she was a fraud.
This call is from a federal prison.
The United States government, or the representatives representing the United States government before the hearing of the Canadian Supreme Court, conceded that they had committed fraud with the Myrtle Poorbear affidavits. So that's Myrtle Poorbear.
And that's Leonard Peltier speaking to us from Leavenworth Prison, where he has now been serving two life sentences in prison for 24 years. We'll come back to this conversation on this day of his interim parole hearing at Leavenworth in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, a rare interview, national broadcast, with Leonard Peltier speaking to us from Leavenworth Prison. He has been in prison for 24 years, serving two life sentences for the murder, first-degree murder of two FBI agents. They were killed in a shootout at Pine Ridge in June 26, 1975, as we continue with the Native American leader.
What is your response to the government attorney in the appellate hearing of your case, Leonard Peltier, saying, we had a murder, we had numerous shooters, we do not know who specifically fired what killing shots, we do not know, quote unquote, who shot the agents?
Well, under the extradition law, this is an international law now, and as we know that the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that treaties are the law of the land. All right, under this law, I was to only be prosecuted for what the United States government was requesting my extradition from, which was first-degree murder. This is the only thing they could prosecute me on, right? I didn't care because they didn't have any evidence. I said, yeah, that's cool, let's go with it. And I get back, and I have a trial. And I'm sure to this myself, up to this day, and I don't have any direct evidence, but I know this is the reason they did it. What the judge did after the jury, after the defense and the prosecution rested, he instructed the jury that they could find me guilty on either first-degree murder, aiding and abetting, or first-degree manslaughter. Now, those jury instructions were supposed to be wrong because I could only be prosecuted on first-degree murder. Now, when we appealed, Judge Webster, who became the FBI director, heard my first appeal, and we found out he was nominated and accepted the nomination for FBI director. We complained and protested it, and we'll try to get a whole new panel to hear the case, but he wouldn't allow that. He just assigned somebody to take his place. They ruled that I was found guilty of first-degree murder. So now that record, and the Supreme Court agreed with it. They refused certiorari, and when they do that, they're saying that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals was correct in their decision. All right. We find ballistics. They also quoted the most critical evidence against me was the murder weapon. Well, then we filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and we found these documents where they had done fingerprint tests, and they came out negative. All right. So, in 1985, the government's claiming now that I was found guilty for, there's no evidence. When the courts are saying there was no evidence of first-degree murder, I filed another appeal in 1992 asking the courts what was I in prison for because of the extradition law, and the court's now saying there's no evidence of first-degree murder. In 1992, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals came back and said, well, you were found guilty of aiding and abetting. So now I'm in prison for aiding and abetting, according to a higher court than the district court. What I'm saying to them is this. If I'm in prison for aiding and abetting, why wasn't I allowed to put up a defense for aiding and abetting? Why am I not being allowed to have the same constitutional rights as any other United States citizen is supposed to have? So, I mean, what they did is they changed every time we get evidence against this and that, they change it over.
Explain what you mean by saying why you weren't allowed to defend yourself against aiding and abetting.
Because after trial, the prosecutor, but my lawyers didn't put it on the record, told us, he said, look, we're only going to prosecute for first-degree murder. And I heard Evan Haltman, chief prosecutor, tell my attorney, Elliot, take off this. And then Elliot came back to the table and told me, I said, I know, they can't. They can't prosecute me for anybody else. I said, and for any other charge. And I said, this is great. I mean, he said, yeah, this is great. They don't have no evidence of first-degree murder. So,
we're talking to Leonard Peltier, who has been in prison for 24 years, speaking to him at the Leavenworth Penitentiary. Leonard Peltier, what about your history? Can you just give us a little sense of your background, where you were born, where you grew up, and why you joined the American Indian Movement.
Well, I'm 55 years old, soon to be 56 in September, September 12th. I was raised on the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation and also the Fort Totten Dakota Reservation. That's our, a lot of people know it as Sioux, but that's not really our real name. That's not the name of our tribe. I was raised there by my grandparents till I was 9 years old. And my grandfather died in 1953, and my grandmother was having a difficult time of taking care of us by herself, and made the fatal mistake of going to the Bureau of Indian Affairs superintendent's office asking for some kind of assistance to help raise us. And they came and got us, me and my sister and my first cousin. They came, about three of us, and they put me in a boarding school, Indian boarding school. I was in an Indian boarding school, which was, although the policy was not to treat us as harshly as they did my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation in these boarding schools, it was still, as we know, government programs die hard. It takes years and years before they're fully abolished, as we see a certain program in the government, it just takes that long to abolish. But we were receiving the same type of brutal treatment that my parents' generation and grandparents' generation were receiving. I stayed there from 9 till about 13. Then I went back to the reservation, and then I went to Flandreau Indian School, high school. Then I went back to the reservation, and about 1958, I started going to tribal community meetings with my father and his generation of people that were organizing around the reservation. What was happening is that there were three reservations selected to be terminated. One was the Menominee Indians out of Wisconsin, the Klamath Falls out of Oregon, and the Turtle Mountain Chippewas of North Dakota. And the policy was we accept termination, or we would not receive any type of social benefits, including commodities. We didn't have any other choice. You know, the ultimate was either stay on the reservation or starve, or accept the relocation and termination. So the people started organizing. And I started attending these meetings with my father. And I started.
This call is from a federal prison.
And I became a runner for them, because we didn't have telephones in those days, or some of us didn't even have cars. So I would run documents from one home to another, which usually were half a mile apart. You know.
If you can speak as loud as you can.
I'm trying a lot of noise right now. I started getting political education of what was happening. And finally, one little girl died of malnutrition on the reservation. And the elders occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs building on, this was 1958, on the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation. Occupied it until the regional office in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the state capital, sent down some representatives from there to see the conditions that Native people were living in, which they did the next day. And I was in the lead car to the caravan cars taking these Bureau of Indian Affairs officials to inspect homes for, show them how much food they had and whatever else.
What brought you to join the American Indian Movement? What year was it?
Well, later on, as I started traveling around, about 16 years old, I got involved with the fishing struggles up in Washington State. I got involved with other Native issues that were happening around there. I was involved in the Fort Lawton takeover, which we built a multi-million dollar structure under. We have alcoholic programs, cultural programs, religious programs, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty prestigious place that we built there.
But I was involved in other things, and I went to Farmington, New Mexico, and I was working on the power plant that they were building on the Navajo Reservation. And in Flagstaff, Arizona, when I was observing, I was staying in this hotel, and I was looking out the window, and I was observing the police, how they were harassing and intimidating and beating Native people. And I just unconsciously got involved and started questioning these police officers of, you know, what gave them the authority to do this. And, of course, you know, almost got arrested. So I started getting politically involved there. I helped build the Indian Center right there in Flagstaff. We built the first one there. And seeing the way Native people were being treated, this was about 1971, I believe it was, I just decided that I was going to continue working with Native people. And I moved to Denver, Colorado, and I ran into Vernon Belcourt there, who was the head of state coordinator for the American Indian Movement in Denver. And Vernon took me out to dinner and explained to me the policies and goals of the American Indian Movement, and I joined up.
And were involved in 1972 in the nonviolent occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building?
Yes, sir. I mean, yes, ma'am. Excuse me. in Washington, D.C., we occupied the building for a week. We, of course, the place was destroyed. I was one of the people in charge of security. And the young people, just out of frustration and anger, we just couldn't control them. They totally destroyed the building, you know, the toilets and stuff like that, like this, but they didn't.
Eventually, in 1975, your involvement in AIM brought you to the Pine Ridge Reservation?
Yes, I had been, about that time, I was being invited to a lot of different reservations because of the conditions of corruption, tribal government corruption, and police brutality and stuff like this. I was invited back to Turtle Mountains. I was invited back to Fort Totten, which I did make. We did make appearances there. We held some hearings. Then we were invited all over the country, and that was basically what we were doing—just organizing all throughout the country. And it was so surprising and encouraging to us that, you know, there wasn't enough of us. We just couldn't get do the work that we need. You know, there wasn't enough of us to do the work that was in demand. I mean, we were getting letters and phone calls from reservations throughout the country that they wanted us to come down there and help them.
When you were at Pine Ridge in 1975, there were many FBI agents there. I believe the highest ratio of FBI agents to citizens in any other area in the country.
Yep.
So how did they deal with all of the murders of Native Americans on the reservation?
Well, according to it, Amy, they're going to shut me off again.
Well, you could just call back.
Yeah, let me call back again, okay? All right.
We're speaking to Leonard Peltier from Leavenworth Prison. He was disconnected and then called back.
You get too strong there at one of the questions you asked me about the agents, but I just get so frustrated after all so many years that it seems that the media, the only thing they want to concentrate on is the death of those two agents. You know, and this is not... This was not the whole deal there. This is, what about those Indians?
Right.
You know, I mean, those people were really killed. You know, the General Accountant Service found over 60.
And what was the FBI doing about it?
Why aren't the media outraged about this?
What was the FBI doing about it at the time?
Well, at the time, apparently nothing, because nobody was being arrested, nobody was being indicted. You know?
they claimed that they couldn't find enough evidence to prosecute anybody, I guess, on the reservation for these murders.
Did you have any information about being watched by the FBI under or being a target of their COINTEL program, the counterintelligence program?
Well, yes. I learned later on that from that incident in Wisconsin that was a fist fight with off-duty police officers, and they tried to make it into a first degree, tried to give me 30 years in prison for that. But one of the officers, his wife, or girlfriend, excuse me, came and testified in my behalf, and she has stated that she couldn't allow this to happen. She was not raised this way and led to believe that law enforcement agencies were honest and would never commit perjury in trial. But she said that her boyfriend had come home bragging that night, carrying my picture, and said, "Hey, we got, you know, this is my career is on the road. We got a big one for the FBI, and we've been assigned to watch out for the American Indian movement and try to do as much as we can to get him and put them in jail." So, you know, like I say, he was carrying. Everybody knew who I was. I was with Dennis Banks all the time. I mean, you know, I was one of his assistants or whatever you want to call us. We really didn't have any titles, but I was with him all the time.
Leonard Peltier, Native American leader in Leavenworth Penitentiary for the past 24 years. We're going to bring you part two of that interview tomorrow. Again, today in Leavenworth will be the interim parole hearing for Peltier. Ultimately, President Clinton decides on executive clemency, but people feel that Janet Reno, who considers it first, is the place to call if you want to voice your opinion. Either way, in the case of Leonard Peltier, her number is, the Attorney General's number is, 202-305-1400. That's 202-305-1400. We'll also be speaking with a lawyer tomorrow to find out how the parole hearing went today. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced with David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch engineered with help from Anthony Sloan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!